Welcome to the Thursday edition of Community Watch and Comment, what we call the on-the-ground edition, where we cover social justice activism with a special emphasis on sustainable living, the environment, economics, labor, and of course, culture and media. Today, a talk about the scholar as activist with author and historian Gerald Horn. I'm Esther Avaram, your Thursday host, and I want to first thank Etan Thomas and Dave Zirin for their sports show, The Collision, and also thank all our listeners who either became members or renewed their membership with WPFW, your listener-powered station for jazz and justice in the nation's capital. I also want to thank you for staying with us and supporting our new show for this jam-packed hour. Our goal is $500 to raise during the next 60 minutes, and we know that's not much for a rare space that I know you appreciate, where voices of activism and direct action can be heard. The number to call is 202-588-9739 or 1-800-222-9739 or WPFWFM.org. Go to that website to support your station for jazz and justice. This drive is a leap of faith of sorts, a new effort to ensure that our listeners will support the programming during the drive. So if you value this approach that emphasizes more programming and less pitching and offering of items, give us a call. But first, before we get to Gerald Horn, other activism in the news. At a rally on Capitol Hill Tuesday, more than 3,000 transit workers from throughout the Northeast called for more support for better and safer public transportation. Those gathered urged Congress to pass legislation to increase transit funding and allow federal money to be used to meet immediate shortfalls in operating budgets. Transit unions are also seeking passage of another stimulus bill, which would provide $8.4 billion for public transit while benefiting the environment, reducing traffic congestion, and sustaining urban and suburban economies. Commemorations have been held worldwide to mark the Nakba, the post-war period in 1948 when hundreds of Palestinian towns and villages were depopulated and destroyed by Israel. Here in Washington, D.C., one such program was held on Tuesday, presenting the scholar Srimati Mitter, the Ernest May Fellow at Harvard University. Mitter's talk recounted how on June 12, 1948, not yet a month after the termination of the British mandate for Palestine, the new government of the State of Israel ordered all the commercial banks operating within its territory to freeze the accounts of all their Arab-Palestinian customers and to stop all transactions on Arab accounts. Palestinians, many of whom were already refugees and scattered in camps throughout the world, lost access to money and financial assets which they had deposited for safekeeping in their bank accounts and safe deposit boxes. The Israel military is being accused of unlawfully killing two unarmed Palestinians during this year's rallies in the occupied West Bank, marking the Nakba. The group Defense for Children International called on the Israel government to launch an investigation. In Chile, an activist says he has destroyed student debt records worth $500 million. Francisco Tapia, known as Papa Fritas or French Fries, says he stole the papers from a for-profit university and burned them in an act of love in order to free the debts of students. The rise of privatized education in Chile began under the dictatorship of General Augusto Pinochet, and the costs for higher education are now among the highest in the world. Meanwhile, in the United States, a new study shows student debt has increased more rapidly at schools with the highest paid presidents. The report by the Institute for Policy Studies looked at public universities with the highest executive pay rates and found that administrative spending outstripped spending on scholarships by more than 2-1. The historian, author, and civil rights activist Vincent Harding has joined the ancestors at the age of 82. He was a friend and speechwriter for Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and co-wrote King's famous anti-war address, Beyond Vietnam. And the labor organizer and educator General Baker has also joined the ancestors. A founder of the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, Baker helped organize wildcat strikes at Detroit auto plants in the 1960s. He was also one of the first public draft resistors during the Vietnam War. We'll be right back with Gerald Horn, who says, writing is fighting. And welcome back to the Thursday edition of Community Watch and Comment, the on-the-ground edition. In the last 3 weeks, we've interviewed New York farmers fighting in federal court here to shut down a fracking operation in their community, healthcare workers earning poverty pay at the number one rated Johns Hopkins Hospital, those protesting the plight of kidnapped Nigerian girls, and those fighting oil and gas corporate giants, Bank of America, and those fighting to save the internet as we know it. So how does the scholar fit into the chorus of activism? How does a scholar combine activism and scholarship? With me today to unpack this issue is the writer and activist Gerald Horn, who is the author of more than 30 books and numerous scholarly articles and a chair of history and African American studies at the University of Houston. He is a frequent commentator and analyst across the Pacifica Network. Welcome to On the Ground, Gerald. Same station, same host, different show. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
So, how does the scholar fit into this chorus of activism? How does a scholar combine activism and scholarship?
Well, you may recall that Kwame Nkrumah, the late leader of independent Ghana, once said that action without thought is empty and thought without action is empty. That is to say that no movement worth its salt can be even contemplated unless there's some sort of intellectual component to it. I mean, it recalls for me being an activist in the 1960s and 1970s, and I recall very vividly how there were many in our movement who felt that unless you came out for armed struggle within the United States, you basically weren't a serious person. But it seems to me, and it seems to me now, that to take such a strong measure as launching armed struggle against a powerful state, you have to have some sort of analysis, a sociological analysis, a historical analysis, an analysis of the forces on the ground, an analysis of what you're going up against, an analysis of whether or not people are going to come to your side and come to your support. And that requires intellectual labor. That requires a fundamental analysis. That requires a certain kind of research. And I would say that not only holds true before you launch armed struggle, that holds true before you launch any kind of political campaign. You have to know what the forces on the ground are like. And so, therefore, it's no contradiction or no incongruity to talk about a scholar activist or an activist scholar, because I think to a greater or lesser degree, all of us who are involved in the movement should be activist scholars or scholar activists.
You know, when you said that, I was just thinking about when Amir Baraka passed. I was listening to one of his poems, actually, and he talked about Kwame Ture. And that's one of the things he said about him. He called him an activist and a scholar.
Kwame Ture, as you may recall, majored in philosophy at Howard University. And that one of the reasons he was catapulted into prominence was because of a book that he co-authored that sold numerous copies entitled Black Power. It's a book that still repays attention. And given his activism in Alabama, given his activism all over the world, it's fair to say that Kwame Ture, Stokely Carmichael, is an exemplar of what I'm discussing.
So is being a scholar, activist scholar, different from being what has been coined as a public intellectual?
Well, there may be some overlap. To the best of my understanding, a goodly number of those who are designated as public intellectuals have not necessarily had organizing experience, on-the-ground organizing experience. Whereas, just to get a a bit of my own biography. I was involved in, as a teenager in my hometown of St. Louis, in protests at the appropriately named Jefferson Bank, which had racist hiring practices. As an undergraduate student at university, I was involved in anti-apartheid activities and organizing takeovers of buildings to protest the university's ties to apartheid South Africa. As a law school student, I was involved in a student strike, one of the few that ever took place at a law school, over the question of affirmative action. For years, I was involved in New York in anti-apartheid activity, helping to raise money for the African National Congress, the Southwest African People's Organization, the now ruling party of Namibia. I led the National Conference of Black Lawyers for a number of years. I was a lawyer for the Hospital Workers Union in New York City, which Martin Luther King called his favorite union. I was former chairman of the Peace and Freedom Party in the state of California, and in 1992 was their candidate for U.S. Senate, racking up about 305,000 votes.
Well, you know, a lot of people don't know that about you. Someone told me, and I said, "Are you sure? Are you sure he was a candidate?" So.
Oh yeah, oh yeah. And so, I've always felt and always thought that one should try to be both a scholar and an activist. And one of the reasons I should say is that I think because the movement in this country is not as large as its responsibilities are. That is to say, we don't have the numbers, quite frankly, which means that those of us who are in the movement, oftentimes we have to work harder. We have to do double duty. We have to do triple duty. And I've always taken that very seriously.
You know, you mentioned being a lawyer, and I wanted to know if it's correct to say that you made the transition from being a lawyer to historian, or, you know, how does the knowledge of the law that you have impact what you write and are drawn to write about?
Well, first of all, there's a certain congruence between being a lawyer and a historian, and both you're weighing evidence. And I would say the same holds true for political activism. That is to say, you have to weigh evidence as a political activist, in many different respects. That is to say, before you decide to hold a demonstration at a certain site, you have to weigh the evidence. I mean, how many people might you be able to attract on a certain day? How much money might you be able to raise to do leaflets or to do posters, etc.? So I recall that as a law school student, one of the most intriguing courses I took was a course on evidence. And I oftentimes recommend, as I did as recently as a few days ago at the University of California, Berkeley, speaking to graduate students in African American studies, that they read textbooks about the laws of evidence. Because I think that when you're a historian or when you're a scholar, you oftentimes have to weigh evidence. I mean, if you're, and as a journalist, of course, you know that. You know that oftentimes if you come to your editor with a story, and they'll often ask you, well, what kinds of corroborating evidence do you have? Is it only one source? Is it two sources? Is it three sources? Do these sources have credibility? So I think that being a lawyer is very helpful in terms of being a writer, being a scholar, and being an activist.
Well, I know that you're used to talking to journalists who are very much focused on today's current events. And, you know, you are actually a very prolific commentator on Pacifica Radio. But how do you tie in your historical work? You know, how is, for example, your most recent book, The Counter-Revolution of 1776, Slave Resistance and the Origins of the United States of America, an example of being a scholar and activist today?
I had mentioned a moment or two ago that the ranks of the movement in the United States are not sizable, which is probably a euphemism. And that's always bothered me, and it's always rankled me. That is to say, why is the right wing so strong in the United States of America? Not only that, but why is the right wing so strong in the Euro-American community across class lines? Why is it that in the Deep South, across class lines, those defined as white oftentimes vote for the right wing at a rate of 90%? Why is it that in 1991, David Duke, a Klansman and a Nazi, won about 55% of the Euro-American vote running for governor in the state of Louisiana. And I was trying to figure this out and puzzle this out. At the same time, many of our friends on the left were espousing the line that this country came into being as a result of a grand progressive revolution. So I was trying to figure out, how was it that there was supposedly this grand progressive revolution in 1776, a step forward for all humanity, that not only led to these political and electoral results that I just described, but also, how was it that you had this so-called grand revolution that led to more Africans being enslaved, that led to the results of Republic, United States of America, replacing the nation it ousted, Britain, as the kingpin of the international slave trade, being responsible for the fact that there are so many Africans in Cuba and Brazil as we speak? How was it that after this so-called Grand Revolution, more land of Native Americans got seized and expropriated? This is not only a question for a political activist. That is to say, if you're trying to make change, well, then you should have some sort of understanding of the people amongst whom you're trying to organize. But it's also a question for a scholar. That is to say, there was a certain incongruity between the so-called Grand Revolution and the subsequent results. And so that's what I chose to investigate in the book you just referenced, The Counter Revolution of 1776. And as the title suggests, I came to the conclusion that the movement that led to the foundations and the origins of the United States of America was not a progressive movement. It was more like the movement in Rhodesia in 1965, when the European minority chose to overthrow British rule in order to forestall decolonization, that is to say, African majority rule. And I came to the conclusion that the movement that overthrew British rule in North America in 1776 was parallel to that insofar as it was designed to forestall the abolition of slavery. And Britain was on a fast track to the abolition of slavery, as I outline in the book. Now, this has both political implications for the activist and scholarly implications. With regard to the former, one of the conclusions that I had already arrived at was that with regard to people of African descent, since we in many ways were the targets in 1776 and have been treated so horrendously since, that my study of our history in North America from the late 17th century up to the present convinces me that in order to make progress, we have to be very alert and very attuned to the global correlation of forces. We oftentimes need global allies, foreign allies, be it Spain in the late 17th century, up through our alliances with the African Liberation Movement in the 1950s, as represented in my book on Kenya. And that is both a political conclusion that should guide political work, I would hope, but it's also a scholarly conclusion based upon close reading of evidence.
A lot of the evidence that you uncover, I think you rely on documents, you know, you're in libraries and stacks and archives, and I think that you like D.C. a lot because you said that we have so many different types of archives and places that you guess you can get lost in and, you know, not surface for like days or something. So what you're doing is part of a longer tradition. And can you talk about some of the others, you know, scholar activists, Du Bois, Eric Williams, Walter Rodney? I mean, we don't have time to talk about all of them in depth, but can you just talk a little bit about that tradition and what it's brought to the table that you've been able to use and build on?
Well, the close listener might have heard echoes of the work of some of the persons you just referenced. I mean, for example, Eric Williams of Trinidad and Tobago, the founding father of that member state of the United Nations, Trinidad and Tobago, wrote a book decades ago called Capitalism and Slavery, which my 1776 book tracks. That is to say that he put forth the thesis that the takeoff for the system known as capitalism was embedded in the African slave trade, and that the system known as capitalism came onto the global stage dripping from every pore with the blood of Africans. Walter Rodney of the state of Guyana on the northern coast of South America, wrote a book similar to that of Eric Williams. And I have to say, I tracked Walter Rodney's book, How Europe Underdeveloped Africa, to a certain degree in writing the 1776 book. W.E.B. Du Bois should need no introduction to your audience, insofar as he was born in the United States and was a founder of the NAACP, was a father of Pan-Africanism, and also wrote quite eloquently about the African slave trade. That was the subject of his first book, which was also his doctoral dissertation, Suppression of the African Slave Trade to the United States of America, where he cites sources. This book was published, believe it or not, in the 1890s. And he cites sources and replicates theses that are still being used to this very day. Kwame Nkrumah, we've already mentioned, and his long list of books and writings that are still being referenced. And then there are what I call the writer actors. I'm thinking of Lorraine Hansberry, Alice Childress, of Shirley Graham Du Bois. And you may know that I wrote a biography of Shirley Graham Du Bois, perhaps better known to your audience as the spouse of W.E.B. Du Bois, but also not only an activist of some note, being a leader of the NAACP in the 1940s when it had its greatest spurt in membership, but also after Du Bois dies in West Africa in the early 1960s, she goes on to play a key role in the government of Kwame Nkrumah in Accra, Ghana, before his regime is overthrown in 1966. Lorraine Hansberry may be better known to your audience because of her award-winning play, Raising the Sun. But before that, she worked shoulder to shoulder with Paul Robeson in Harlem on his newspaper, Freedom, where she was not only sort of an investigative journalist, but you might even call an activist journalist, uncovering stories that then led to political struggles. And the same holds true for Alice Childress, better known perhaps as a writer, as a novelist and playwright, but also worked shoulder to shoulder with Paul Robeson. So this tradition that you're referencing today has deep roots in our community and in our movement.
And you know, you ended on the perfect note because we're in our spring fund drive at WPFW, and the idea that the work of journalists, the work of writers, the work of scholar activists leaves a record for historians like yourself to later not only just read, but kind of put into a larger context seems to be very important. It seems to be very apropos to what we're trying to do today. You're listening to the Thursday edition of Community Watch and Comment. I'm Esther Avaram, your host and creator of a new segment that we're calling On the Ground on Thursdays. And what we're trying to do is bring the voices of activists and voices you may not hear, that you won't hear elsewhere, to the airwaves every Thursday. We're talking to the writer and activist Gerald Horn today, author of more than 30 books. And we're talking about the role of the scholar activist. And if you value that, because we know you value that, we want you to call 202-588-9739. That's 202-588-9739 or 1-800-222-9739. If you're listening online, you can pledge right on our website at WPFWFM.org and go to the donate page, pull down the menu that says the Thursday edition of Community Watch and Comment, and pledge right there. We're encouraging everyone to renew their membership or become a new member at the sustainer level for as little as $10 a month. A special challenge to all those who are paying cable bills or paying all kinds of bills out of their accounts every month. Just $10 a month to support public radio, to support Voices of the People. We're not brought to you by underwriting. We're not brought to you by the weapons manufacturers, the oil and gas industry, Big Pharma, or the telecommunications giants. We don't receive support like commercial radio does. We're not associated with a university. And we rely on you. You are our sponsors. So don't forget to go to the phone. A challenge to all the activists out there to have a place where your voices can be heard. The number I want you to remember is 202-588-9739 to reach our volunteers, or 1-800-222-9739. Gerald, do you have any thoughts on the role of Pacifica, the importance of Pacifica in today's media?
I consider Pacifica to be one of the most important progressive institutions in our nation, in our movement, and that if we're ever going to move forward, if we're ever going to get to the point where we can seriously talk about a radical transformation, we're going to need a very strong and vibrant Pacifica. And that's why I urge and encourage anyone within range of my voice to pledge immediately, if not sooner.
Now, let's get back to some of our discussion. I've been following somewhat this recent conversation about the new book, Capital in the 21st Century, by the French economist Thomas Piketty, and it's a bestseller. In it, he documents the tremendous rise in income inequality and rebuts claims by the right wing that the wealthy became or stay wealthy because of hard work. And seemingly the only response by the right has been to call Piketty a Marxist. What is your reaction, you know, as you observe that debate or that discussion? And as someone who's never been afraid to acknowledge a Marxist analysis in your own writing.
Well, talking about this bestseller allows me the opportunity to tease out further the distinction earlier made between perhaps a public intellectual and a scholar activist, because I salute the author, Thomas Piketty, for his diligent research in showing or seeking to show how inequality is embedded in the system known as capitalism. I think it's a marvelous piece of work, a marvelous piece of scholarship. And that in the country as right-leaning as the United States of America, the fact that it soared to the top of the bestseller list, nothing short of a marvel. I mean, it's fantastic. On the other hand, as a philosopher once said in the 19th century, it's not enough to understand the world, we have to change it. And I think that when you get to the remedies that the author puts forward, and even to a degree his analysis, he shows why he's not a scholar activist, but more public intellectual. In other words, in terms of his analysis, he doesn't necessarily get into the power imbalance between those who control capital and those who work for those who control capital. Trade unions, which are a major source of defense, that is to say working class people, people who have to sell their wages for a living, trade unions are not at the forefront of this analysis. And with regard to the global wealth tax that he proposes, well, it's all very well and good to come up with remedies and solutions, but if you're talking about the United States of America, where a Republican Party is in ascendancy, which feels that a global wealth tax would be something akin to the mark of the devil, would view a global wealth tax or a taxing capitalist, taxing those more heavily who have wealth, they would see that as the devil would see holy water. And so a scholar activist, to repeat, would have to make an assessment of the correlation of forces, like a general on the battlefield. Who's on the other side? How many forces do you have on your side? And what can you do if the other side is stronger? I mean, do you do a guerrilla type action? Do you do a frontal type action? Do you do a retreat? Do you do an encirclement? Do you try to call in others from beyond the battlefield? I mean, all of these basic fundamental questions are not part of his analysis. But having said that, I don't want to dwell too long on the negative, because once again, I think it's a marvelous contribution that this author has made.
I'm curious about whether the academy, you know, looks down its nose at activist scholars in the same way that the literary academy looks down on activist poets, writers, and journalists, you know, as if there's some divide that exists between so-called like pure scholarship and scholarship that advocates for or tells the story of marginalized humanity. There's just a lot of parallels there that I see between kind of the writing community and the community of historians or economists.
Well, you're right. But once again, writing is fighting. And so if you're fighting, you expect to get hit. It's not like you just throw all the blows and don't expect to absorb a few. And yeah. So sure, in the academy, there are various ways to try to attack and demean and undermine scholar activists, but that's part of the landscape. I mean, that's the price of the ticket. I mean, I oftentimes think to myself and say to other people that in some ways, as of May 2014, that's a small price to pay. I mean, I haven't been indicted yet, so that's what I'm happy about. So the fact that some weak scholar doesn't like what I'm writing, I think that's a small price to pay. And the fact that, say, my 1776 book, the fact that scholars in the field, some of whom, of course, have endorsed it, but others will not, because I'm basically calling upon them to retool and to take a different approach and perhaps to study harder and perhaps to write something different. Of course, they're not going to take that very well. But that's the price of the ticket. And once again, it's a very small price to pay. And that's how I see it.
You know, when you start talking about the just little known stories out there that, you know, people don't hear because we're kind of living in this media culture saturated with just kind of just nonsense, things that distract people from not only like history that might be kind of edifying, but just what's really happening in their lives today. And that's what we try to focus on here at WPFW, here in the nation's capital, your station for jazz and justice. And we are in our spring fun drive. This is the type of programming that we want to bring to you, that we do bring to you. So, you know, we want to stress that it's our station for jazz and justice. And justice is what we're talking about today. Justice in for activists, for activism, for the voices of humanity that don't get heard in the larger corporate media. So I want you to call 202-588-9739. That's 202-588-9739 or 1-800-222-9739. If you're online, go to WPFWFM.org. and make your pledge. There are some thank you gifts there. But what we're trying to do in this pledge drive is kind of grow up a little bit and have our listeners grow up with us too. We want people to pledge for the value they get from the programming. And that's our challenge this spring. And help us meet that challenge. I've been talking to activist and scholar Gerald Horn about the role of the activist scholar. For the past 3 weeks, 4 weeks, we've been bringing you all types of activists in the street, people trying to save the internet, trying to save their farming community, trying to advocate on behalf of the 300 Nigerian girls kidnapped, voices from Occupy that don't get heard anymore, people trying to enter shareholder meetings and protest and occupy at Bank of America. And so today we're bringing you the voice of the scholar activists, and we want you to go to the phones, 202-588-9739 or 1-800-222-9739. Katia is going to take over and take your calls here at the bottom of the hour. And you can call in, but don't forget to call in pledge now, but you can call in and make your comments about the role of the scholar activist. How important is it for us to be able to research and write and present information about our history, the correct history, the full history? How important is that to the role of the activist? How important is it for us to have the right tools of information and perspective to do our work today, to basically fight for our lives? So I want to thank Gerald Horn for joining me this morning and taking time away from his work in the stacks and his, you know, many books and things he's working on to talk with me this morning on the ground. Thank you, Gerald.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
Hi, I'm Amira Woods, and this is your WPFW Social Justice Calendar for the Washington metro area. Thursday, May 22nd, Photography and Social Justice by Doug Mills, a photographer who covers the White House and Capitol Hill, will showcase some of his most famous photographs and discuss how photography impacts social justice. 7 to 9 p.m. at Gannett, 7950 Jones Branch Drive, McLean, Virginia. For more information and to RSVP, call 202-427-1455 or visit justiceforall, that's the number 4.org. If you'd like your event included in the social justice calendar, send a plain text email 2 weeks in advance to socialjusticewpfw@ips-dc.org. with the event title and date in the subject line and no attachments. The Social Justice Calendar is a public service brought to you by the Institute for Policy Studies in partnership with WPFW, your station for jazz and justice.
Tell me a little bit about those prices, though. I mean, you know, we may not hear about that side of it. You know, those of us who are like listening in radio land, we may not have insight or into what's really happening in the world between scholars, between historians. So, you know, what kind of blows are you talking about? What kind of, you know, can you tell me a little bit about the maybe a fight that you've had to be a part of?
Oh, sure. But once again, I don't want to make too much of it, because in other countries, people get thrown in jail or tortured, etc. And what I'm about to talk about is going to sound very trivial in that context. So people should keep that in mind. So I don't want to dwell on this too long. But I mean, for example, if you're doing a scholarly work, it has to go through peer review. And peer review, that is to say, other scholars read it, and oftentimes they read it anonymously. And behind the mask of anonymity, of course, people can say some very nasty things and can try to keep things from being published, try to prevent works from seeing the light of day. That happens all the time. If you're in a history department, well, fortunately, and let me say for the record that I have very good and positive relations with my colleagues, but I know that that's not always the case for people like myself in other kinds of departments. That is to say that they're being constantly undermined and unfairly attacked, almost to the point of defamation. My own personal approach as a scholar in the academy in a university, which is basically a major bureaucracy, is to focus on productivity, focus on producing books in the first place. And in terms of personal relations, I adopt the slogan that Turkey adopted some years ago before it jumped it. That is to say, zero problems with neighbors. That is to say, if I try to be in my personal relations, not only with my peers in the history department, but just about anybody, to be very warm and friendly and engaging. Because I feel that in the long run, that brings fewer problems. Not only that, but you know, people in the United States oftentimes carry guns, and so it's not healthy to be otherwise than warm, friendly, and engaging towards them.
Yeah, and I guess, I mean, some state just passed a law so that people could carry guns on college campuses or something.
Exactly.
Wow.
As a matter of fact, I teach in the state of Texas.
I worry about you sometimes down there.
Where that kind of mentality is rampant. I remember one time I was joking to students about that sort of legislation. And I asked some of the students, were any of them carrying guns? And I was, you know, I thought I was making a smart joke. And a few of them raised their hands. So as I said, I think the better part of wisdom is to try at all times, to the extent possible, in terms of personal and diplomatic relations, to be warm, engaging, and to take out one's anger on the printed page in your writing on the media, for example, but not necessarily in face-to-face encounters with these rabid, gun-toting idiots.
Right. Well, you know, I was actually listening to an interview you did on NPR about your book on the screenwriter John Howard Lawson. And you said in the interview that, you know, red baiters kind of went after screenwriters because the words in film and as an extension, I guess, you know, film itself, you know, is a very powerful tool. And a very powerful tool that could massage the consciousness or defame entire communities or not. So that idea seems to fit precisely into this topic of, you know, fighting by writing or writing is fighting. What do you say about that?
Well, you hit the nail on the head. Although, of course, when you compare what a screenwriter can accomplish versus what a historian can accomplish, I mean, basically, there's no comparison. But that reminds me of what the progressive screenwriter Dalton Trumbo once said. Dalton Trumbo may have been the most talented screenwriter ever to be produced in Hollywood, and of course, was served a term in prison in the 1950s because of his being convicted for thought crimes, not unlike his comrade, John Howard Lawson, who I wrote a biography about. And Trumbo said...
Wait a minute, did you say thought crimes?
Well, yeah, basically.
Because that's like very 1984, but you're talking about the United States. I just want people to be clear.
Oh, yeah, sure. And I mean, I won't dwell on that too long. I'll just point people to my book to get a definition of what I'm referring to.
But and the title, say the title again.
The Lawson biography is The Final Victim of the Blacklist, John Howard Lawson, Dean of the Hollywood 10.
Right.
And Dalton Trumbo, his comrade, said that in terms of intellectual production, that one's ability to be progressive or radical is oftentimes tracked by how much capital is invested in the enterprise. In other words, a poet writing a solitary poem can be very radical and progressive, particularly if they're only going to declaim it at a poetry slam. Whereas a screenwriter who's taking sometimes millions and millions of dollars from Hollywood studios, who are ultimately backed by Wall Street banks and investment firms and hedge funds, well, it's very difficult. It's more difficult for that screenwriter to produce something progressive because of all the capital that goes into the enterprise, which is why to produce a progressive film in a right-leaning country in the United States, at times it seems nothing less than a miracle. But it does happen from time to time, which is why we should salute those who are involved with those enterprises, particularly the film writers, because as I said in my Lawson biography, I think that the screenwriters have gotten received short shrift in terms of the contemplation of film and movies. And that is to say that the director will find it difficult to go forward unless there's a script in hand. And the script is the blueprint. And a construction company will find it difficult to construct the building unless there's an architectural blueprint or some sort of writing in hand. And I think that it's not accidental that screenwriters who are so essential to this enterprise, who oftentimes, as my biography of Lawson suggested, tends to lean in progressive direction, have received such short shrift. And today, if you look at the way screenwriters are portrayed, even in Hollywood movies, they're oftentimes portrayed in a very negative light.
You know, I suppose when it comes to writing, whether it's journalism, whether it's history, whether it's screenwriting, you know, ultimately, you know, the progressive writer, he has to just be clear that their facts are right. I mean, it seems that, you know, even if your facts are right, people want to come and challenge you, but ultimately they don't really have anything to attack you with.
Oh, that's sure. But once again, just to put this in context, and fortunately, as of May 2014, unlike writers in other countries, we have to deal with bad reviews. We have to deal with unfair reviews. But as of today, for many of us, we're not necessarily dealing with torture.
Right.
Waterboarding, for example.
Yeah, there's a poet in, I think, Bahrain, another poet in Saudi Arabia. And, of course, you know, we know the story of the poet in Nigeria. People who, you know, were basically killed for just speaking. So,
yes, I mean, but at the same time, to flip the coin over, just because we're not subjected to waterboarding doesn't mean we shouldn't be struggling and fighting against the unfairness we are subjected to.
Yes.
Because if we're not struggling and fighting against that, pretty soon we will be subjected to waterboarding. So it's in our material interest to do so.
Yeah. Earlier this year, I think when I was still doing AM Alternative, you know, we were discussing developments in the Ukraine. And, you know, I wanted to ask you at that time, you know, how this era will be characterized, you know, how you think it will be characterized by historians in the future.
Well, assuming, well, you mentioned Ukraine, and there's been a lot of loose talk about World War III as a result of this Ukraine crisis. And as Albert Einstein once said, he wasn't sure how World War III would unfold, but he was certain that World War IV would be fought with sticks and stones. So, assuming that humanity continues to survive, and assuming that climate change does not overcome us all, I think that your grandchildren will probably have, I'm afraid, a negative characterization, not only of the United States and U.S. imperialism, I mean, that's a no-brainer, but also perhaps a negative characterization of some aspects of our movement because of our seeming inability to mount a serious offensive against U.S. imperialism and its depredations around the world, which presupposes, to bring us full circle, an adequate and accurate analysis of the forces on the ground, an adequate and accurate analysis of the history of this country, that is unafraid to look the ugliness in the face, that's unafraid to sail into the teeth of headwinds and suggest boldly and fiercely that the forces that founded the United States of America in the late 18th century were not necessarily exemplars of progressive humanity, and to be able to absorb the brickbats that inevitably will ensue from making such an analysis. And until we're able to do such a thing, as I've just sketched an outline, I think that your grandchildren, or who are historians, will just shake their heads in bafflement and wonder at some of the things we were thinking and saying in 2014.
So what are some of the things that you are working on right now, and what are you keeping your eye on? I know the Ukraine is one of those things, but...
Well, what am I keeping going? That's an exciting question. How much time do we have?
I know. Boy, that opens a can of worms. I've seen you, like, go on a riff, like, around the globe. So maybe I should open myself up to that. But, well, you know, just a couple things that you're keeping your eye on that you think are important and what you're working on now.
Feel free to interrupt me.
Okay.
Because you're taking the cap off. So the words will begin to flow. Now, I'm looking at Russia-China relations. Vladimir Putin is slated to be in Beijing this week. There's an orientation of Russian energy from Western Europe to China. And U.S. policy, at least since Henry Kissinger, has been based upon driving a wedge between Russia and China. And now they're getting closer together. I'm looking at Germany, which the Wall Street Journal has been excoriating, saying that Germany, a key member of the so-called Atlantic Alliance, sees itself now as a new kind of Switzerland if Germany did not participate in the misadventure in Libya, for example. And Germany has been trying to play a mediating role between Washington and Moscow as opposed to being on Washington's side. I'm looking at the new role of Brazil. I'm looking at the African development that's taking place, not least because of Chinese investment. With regard to what I'm working on a number of different projects. I'm working on a short biography of Paul Robeson, the actor, activist, and I would also say scholar. I'm working on a book on relations between the United States and Haiti from the time of the late 18th century revolution up to the failed annexation of the island of Hispaniola that includes Haiti and the Dominican Republic. That failed annexation taking place circa 1870-1871. I'm working on a book on the Black Press, the Associated Negro Press, which was headquartered in Chicago, which had correspondents all over the world, which hired the best writers in the world, including Zora Neale Hurston, Langston Hughes, and all the rest. And paradoxically, fell apart as Jim Crow was crumbling in the 1960s. I'm working on a book on Black people in aviation. Although Orville and Wilbur Wright have been given credit for inventing the airplane in 1903, the fact of the matter is that before that, you had many U.S. Negroes, as they were then called, trying to devise airplanes to try to find a way to get out of this hellhole, and developed over the decades a fond fascination with airplanes, not least because they felt that these new devices would be used against them, which was true in Tulsa, as you know, approximately 90 years ago when the so-called Black Wall Street was decimated.
Wow.
You may know of John Robinson, the Black American pilot from Chicago, who goes to Ethiopia in the 1930s, helped to start the Ethiopian Air Force, and later starts Ethiopian Airways, one of the major carriers on the continent to this very day.
Wow, wow, wow. I will cut you off, because I know that it's just all fascinating. And, you know, when you start talking about the just little known stories out there that, you know, people don't hear because we're kind of living in this media culture saturated with just kind of just nonsense, you know, just entertainment nonsense, things that distract people from not only like history that might be kind of edifying, but just what's really happening in their lives today. And that's what we try to focus on here at WPFW, here in the nation's capital, your station for jazz and justice. And we are in our spring fun drive. This is the type of programming that we want to bring to you, that we do bring to you. So, you know, we want to stress that it's our station for jazz and justice. And justice is what we're talking about today. Justice in for activists, for activism, for the voices of humanity that don't get heard in the larger corporate media. So I want you to call 202-588-9739. That's 202-588-9739 or 1-800-222-9739. If you're online, go to WPFWFM.org and make your pledge. There are some thank you gifts there. But what we're trying to do in this pledge drive is kind of grow up a little bit and have our listeners grow up with us too. We want people to pledge for the value they get from the programming. And that's our challenge this spring. And help us meet that challenge. I've been talking to activist and scholar Gerald Horn about the role of the activist scholar. For the past 3 weeks, 4 weeks, we've been bringing you all types of activists in the street, people trying to save the internet, trying to save their farming community, trying to advocate on behalf of the 300 Nigerian girls kidnapped, voices from Occupy that don't get heard anymore, people trying to enter shareholder meetings and protest and occupy at Bank of America. And so today we're bringing you the voice of the scholar activists, and we want you to go to the phones, 202-588-9739 or 1-800-222-9739.